This is Audible.
Simon & Schuster Audio presents End of Watch by Stephen King. Read by Will Patton. For Thomas Harris. Get me a gun. Go back into my room. I'm gonna get me a gun. One with a barrel or two. You know I'm better off dead than singing these suicide blues. Cross Canadian Ragweed. April 10th, 2009. Martine Stover. It's always darkest before the dawn. This elderly chestnut occurred to Rob Martin as the ambulance he drove rolled slowly along Upper Marlboro Street toward home base, which was Firehouse 3. It seemed to him that whoever thought that one up really got hold of something, because it was darker than a woodchuck's asshole this morning and dawn wasn't far away. Not that this daybreak would be up to much even when it finally got rolling. Call it dawn with a hangover. The fog was heavy and smelled of the nearby not-so-great Great Lake. A fine cold drizzle had begun to fall through it just to add to the fun. Rob clicked the wiper control from intermittent to slow. Not far up ahead, two unmistakable yellow arches rose from the murk.
"The golden tits of America," Jason Rapsis cried from the shotgun seat.
Rob had worked with any number of paramedics over his 15 years as an EMT, and Jace Rapsis was the best. Easygoing when nothing was happening, unflappable and sharply focused when everything was happening at once.
"We shall be fed! God bless capitalism! Pull in, pull in!"
"Are you sure?" Rob asked. "After the object lesson we just had and what that shit can do?" The run from which they were now returning had been to one of the McMansions in Sugar Heights, where a man named Harvey Galen had called 911 complaining of terrible chest pains. They had found him lying on the sofa in what rich folks no doubt called the Great Room, a beached whale of a man in blue silk pajamas. His wife was hovering over him, convinced he was going to punch out at any second.
"Mickey D's, Mickey D's," Jason chanted.
He was bouncing up and down in his seat. The gravely competent professional who had taken Mr. Galen's vitals, Rob right beside him holding the first in bag with its airway management gear and cardiac meds, had disappeared. With his blonde hair flopping in his eyes, Jason looked like an overgrown kid of 14.
"Pull in, I say!"
Rob pulled in. He could get behind a sausage biscuit himself, and maybe one of those hash brown thingies that looked like a baked buffalo tongue. There was a short line of cars at the drive-thru. Rob snuggled up at the end of it.
"Besides, it's not like the guy had a for real heart attack," Jason said. "Just OD'd on Mexican. Refused to lift to the hospital, didn't he?"
"He had. After a few hearty belches and one trombone blast from his nether regions that had his social x-ray of a wife booking for the kitchen, Mr. Galen sat up, said he was feeling much better, and told them that no, he didn't think he needed to be transported to Kiner Memorial." Rob and Jason didn't think so either after listening to a recitation of what Galen had put away at Tijuana Rose the night before. His pulse was strong, and although his blood pressure was on the iffy side, it probably had been for years and was currently stable. The automatic external defibrillator never came out of its canvas sack.
"I want 2 egg McMuffins and 2 hash browns," Jason announced. "Black coffee. On second thought, make that 3 hash browns."
Rob was still thinking about Galen. It was indigestion this time, but it'll be the real thing soon enough. Thunderclap infarction. "Where do you think he went? 300? 350?
325 at least," Jason said. "Stop trying to spoil my breakfast."
Rob waved his arm at the golden arches rising through the lake effect fog. "This place and all the other grease pits like it are half of what's wrong with America.
As a medical person, I'm sure you know that. What you just ordered, that's 900 calories on the hoof, bro. Add sausage to the Egg McMuff divers and you're riding right around 1,300. What are you having, Dr. Health?
Sausage biscuit, maybe two. Jason clapped him on the shoulder.
My man!
The line moved forward. They were two cars from the window when the radio beneath the in-dash computer blared. Dispatchers were usually cool, calm, and collected, but this one sounded like a radio shock jock after too many Red Bulls.
All ambulances and fire apparatus. We have an MCI. I repeat, MCI. This is a high-priority call for all ambulances and fire apparatus.
MCI, short for Mass Casualty Incident. Rob and Jason stared at each other. Plane crash, train crash, explosion, or act of terrorism. It almost had to be one of the four.
Location is City Center on Marlboro Street. Repeat, City Center on Marlboro. Once again, this is an MCI with multiple deaths likely. Use caution.
Rob Martin's stomach tightened. No one told you to use caution when heading to a crash site or gas explosion. That left an act of terrorism, and it might still be in progress. Dispatch was going into her spiel again. Jason hit the lights and siren while Rob cranked the wheel and pulled the Freightliner Ambo into the lane that skirted the restaurant, clipping the bumper of the car ahead of him. They were just 9 blocks from City Center, but if Al-Qaeda was shooting the place up with Kalashnikovs, the only thing they had to fire back with was their trusty external defibrillator. Jason grabbed the mic.
Copy, dispatch. This is 23 out of Firehouse 3, ETA, just about 6 minutes.
Other sirens were rising from other parts of the city, but judging from the sound, Rob guessed their ambo was closest to the scene. A cast iron light had begun creeping into the air, and as they wheeled out of McDonald's and onto Upper Marlboro, a gray car knitted itself out of the gray fog, a big sedan with a dented hood and badly rusted grille. For a moment, the HD headlights on high beam were pointed straight at them. Rob hit the dual air horns and swerved. The car, it looked like a Mercedes, although he couldn't be sure, slewed back into its own lane and was then nothing but taillights dwindling into the fog.
Jesus Christ, that was close, Jason said. Don't suppose you got the license plate?
No. Rob's heart was beating so hard he could feel it pulsing on both sides of his throat. I was busy saving our lives. Listen, how can there be multiple casualties at City Center? God isn't even up yet. It's got to be closed.
Could have been a bus crash.
Try again. They don't start running until 6. Sirens. Sirens everywhere, beginning to converge like blips on a radar screen. A police car went bolting past them, but so far as Rob could tell, they were still ahead of the other ambos and fire trucks. Which gives us a chance to be the first to get shot or blown up by a mad Arab shouting Allahu Akbar, he thought. How nice for us. But the job was the job, so he swung onto the steep drive leading up to the main city administration buildings and the butt-ugly auditorium where he'd voted until moving out to the suburbs.
Break! Jason screamed. Jesus fuck, Robbie, break!
Scores of people were coming at them from the fog, a few sprinting nearly out of control because of the incline. Some were screaming. One guy fell down, rolled, picked himself up, and ran on with his torn shirt tail flapping beneath his jacket. Rob saw a woman with shredded hose, bloody shins, and only one shoe. He came to a panic stop, the nose of the ambo dipping, unsecured shit flying. Meds, IV bottles, and needle packs from a cabinet left unsecured, a violation of protocol, became projectiles. The stretcher they hadn't had to use for Mr. Galen bounced off one wall. A stethoscope found the pass-through, smacked the windshield, and fell onto the center console.
Creep along, Jason said. Just creep, okay? Let's not make it worse.
Rob feathered the gas and continued up the slope, now at walking pace. Still they came. Hundreds, it seemed. Some bleeding, most not visibly hurt, all of them terrified. Jason unrolled the passenger window and leaned out.
What's going on? Somebody tell me what's going on.
A man pulled up, red-faced and gasping.
It was a car. Tore through the crowd like a mowing machine. Fucking maniac just missed me. I don't know how many he hit. We were pinned in like hogs because of the posts they set up to keep people in line. He did it on purpose, and they're laying around up there like, oh, man, dolls filled with blood. I saw at least 4 dead. There's gotta be more.
The guy started to move on, plodding now instead of running as the adrenaline faded. Jason unhooked his seatbelt and leaned out to call after him.
Did you see what color it was? The car that did it?
The man turned back, pale and haggard.
Gray. Great big gray car.
Jason sat back down and looked at Rob. Neither of them had to say it out loud. It was the one they had swerved to avoid as they came out of McDonald's, and that hadn't been rust on its snout after all.
Go, Robbie. We'll worry about the messing back later. Just get us to the prom and don't hit anyone, yeah?
Okay. By the time Rob arrived in the parking lot, the panic was abating. Some people were leaving at a walk. Others were trying to help those who had been struck by the gray car. A few, the assholes present in every crowd, were snapping photos or making movies with their phones, hoping to go viral on YouTube, Rob assumed. Chrome posts with yellow "Do Not Cross" tape trailing from them lay on the pavement. The police car that had passed them was parked close to the building, near a sleeping bag with a slim white hand protruding. A man lay sprawled crossways on top of the bag, which was in the center of a spreading blood puddle. The cop motioned the ambo forward, his beckoning arm seeming to stutter in the swinging blue glare of the light bar atop his cruiser. Rob grabbed the mobile data terminal and got out while Jason ran around to the rear of the ambo. He emerged with his first in bag and the external defibrillator. The day continued to brighten, and Rob could read the sign flapping over the main doors of the auditorium. 1,000 jobs guaranteed. We stand with the people of our city. Mayor Ralph Kinsler. Okay, that explained why there had been such a crowd and so early in the morning. A job fair. Times were tough everywhere, had been since the economy had its own thunderclap infarction the year before, but they had been especially tough in this little lakefront city where the jobs had started bleeding away even before the turn of the century. Rob and Jason started toward the sleeping bag, but the cop shook his head. His face was ashen.
This guy and the 2 in the bag are dead. His wife and baby, I guess. He must have been trying to protect them.
He made a brief sound, deep in his throat, something between a burp and a retch, clapped a hand over his mouth, then took it away and pointed.
That lady there might still be with us.
The lady in question was sprawled on her back, her legs twisted away from her upper body at an angle that suggested serious trauma. The crotch of her dressy beige slacks was dark with urine. Her face, what remained of it, was smeared with grease. Part of her nose and most of her upper lip had been torn away. Her beautifully capped teeth were bared in an unconscious snarl. Her coat and half of her roll-neck sweater had also been torn away. Great dark bruises were flowering on her neck and shoulder. Fucking car ran right over her, Rob thought. Squashed her like a chipmunk. He and Jason knelt beside her, snapping on blue gloves. Her purse lay nearby, marked by a partial tire track. Rob picked it up and heaved it into the back of the ambo, thinking the tire print might turn out to be evidence or something. And of course the woman would want it. If she lived, that was.
She stopped breathing, but I got a pulse, Jason said. Weak and thready. Tear down that sweater.
Rob did it, and half the bra, strap shredded, came with it. He pushed the rest down to get it out of the way, then began chest compressions while Jason started an airway.
She going to make it?
The cop asked. I don't know, Rob said. We got this. You've got other problems. If more rescue vehicles come steaming up the drive like we almost did, someone's going to get killed.
Oh, man, there are people lying hurt everywhere. It's like a battlefield.
Help the ones you can.
She's breathing again, Jason said. Get with me, Robbie. Let's save a life here. Hop on the MDT and tell Kina we're bringing in a possible neck fracture, spinal trauma, internal injuries, facial injuries, God knows what else. Condition critical. I'll feed you her vitals.
Rob made the call from the mobile data terminal while Jason continued squeezing the ambu bag. Kiner ER answered immediately, the voice on the other end crisp and calm. Kiner was a level 1 trauma center, which was sometimes called presidential class, and ready for something like this. They trained for it 5 times a year. With the call-in made, he got an O2 level, predictably lousy, and then grabbed both the rigid cervical collar and the orange backboard from the ambo. Other rescue vehicles were arriving now, and the fog had begun to lift, making the magnitude of the disaster clear. All with one car, Rob thought. Who would believe it?
Okay, Jason said. If she ain't stable, it's the best we can do. Let's get her on board.
Careful to keep the backboard perfectly horizontal, they lifted her into the ambo, placed her on the stretcher, and secured her. With her pallid, disfigured face framed by the cervical collar, she looked like one of the ritual female victims in a horror movie. Except those were always young and nubile, and this woman looked to be in her 40s or early 50s. Too old to be job hunting, you would have said, and Rob only had to look at her to know she would never go job hunting again, or walk from the look of her. With fantastic luck, she might avoid quadriplegia, assuming she got through this, but Rob guessed that her life from the waist down was over. Jason knelt, slipped a clear plastic mask over her mouth and nose, and started the oxygen from the tank at the head of the stretcher. The mask fogged up, a good sign. "Next thing?" Rob asked, meaning, "What else can I do?"
"Find some epi in that junk that flew around, or get it out of my bag. I had a good pulse for a while there, but it's gone thready again. Then fire this monkey up. With the injuries she sustained, it's a miracle she's alive at all."
Rob found an ampoule of epinephrine under a tumbled box of bandages and handed it over. Then he slammed the back doors, dropped into the driver's seat, and got cranking. First to the scene at an MCI meant first to the hospital. That would improve this lady's slim chances just a little bit. Still, it was a 15-minute run, even in light morning traffic, and he expected her to be dead by the time they got to Ralph M. Kiner Memorial Hospital. Given the extent of her injuries, that might be the best outcome. But she wasn't. At 3 o'clock that afternoon, long after their shift was over but too wired to even think about going home, Rob and Jason sat in the ready room of Firehouse 3 watching ESPN on mute. They had made 8 runs in all, but the woman had been the worst. "Martine Stover, that was her name," Jason said at last. "She's still in surgery. I called while you were in the can." "Any idea what her chances are?" "No, but they didn't just let her crater, and that means something. Pretty sure she was there looking for an executive secretary's position. I went in her purse for ID, got a blood type from her driver's license, and found a whole sheaf of references. Looks like she was good at her job. Last position was at the Bank of America. Got downsized. And if she lives, what do you think? Just the legs?" Jason stared at the TV where basketball players were running fleetly up the court and said nothing for a long while. Then, "If she lives, she's going to be a quad."
"For sure?"
95%. A beer ad came on. Young people dancing up a storm in a bar. Everyone having fun. For Martine Stover, the fun was over. Rob tried to imagine what she would be facing if she pulled through. Life in a motorized wheelchair that she moved by puffing into a tube, being fed either pureed gluck or through IV tubes, respirator-assisted breathing, shitting into a bag, life in a medical twilight zone. "Christopher Reeve didn't do so bad," Jason said as if reading his thoughts. "Good attitude, good role model, kept his chin up, even directed a movie, I think."
"Sure he kept his chin up," Rob said, "thanks to a cervical collar that never came off, and he's dead."
"She was wearing her best clothes," Jason said. "Good slacks, expensive sweater, nice coat, trying to get back on her feet, and some bastard comes along and takes it all."
"Did they get him yet?"
"Not the last I heard. When they do, I hope they string him up by the nutsack."
The following night, while delivering the stroke victim to Kiner Memorial, the partners checked on Martine Stover. She was in the ICU and showing those signs of increasing brain function that signaled the imminent recovery of consciousness. When she did come back, someone would have to give her the bad news. She was paralyzed from the chest down. Rob Martin was just glad it wouldn't have to be him. And the man the press was calling the Mercedes Killer still hadn't been caught. Z. January 2016. 1. A pane of glass breaks in Bill Hodges' pants pocket. This is followed by a jubilant chorus of boys shouting, "That's a home run!" Hodges winces and jumps in his seat. Dr. Stamos is part of a 4-doctor cabal, and the waiting room is full this Monday morning. Everyone turns to look at him. Hodges feels his face grow warm. "Sorry," he says to the room at large. text message.
And a very loud one, remarks an old lady with thinning white hair and beagle dewlaps. She makes Hodges feel like a kid and he's pushing 70. She's hip to cell phone etiquette, though.
You should lower the volume in public places like this, or mute your phone entirely.
Absolutely, absolutely.
The old lady goes back to her paperback. It's 50 Shades of Grey and not her first trip through it from the battered look of the thing.
Hodges drags his iPhone out of his pocket.
The text is from Pete Huntley, his old partner when Hodges was on the cops. Pete is now on the verge of pulling the pin himself, hard to believe but true. End of watch is what they call it. But Hodges himself has found it impossible to give up watching. He now runs a little two-person firm called Finders Keepers. He calls himself an independent skip tracer because he got into a little trouble a few years back and can't qualify for a private investigator's license. In this city, you have to be bonded. But a PI is what he is, at least some of the time.
Call me Kermit. ASAP. Important.
Kermit is Hodges' actual first name, but he goes by the middle one with most people. It keeps the frog jokes to a minimum. Pete makes a practice of using it, though, finds it hilarious. Hodges considers just pocketing the phone again, after muting it, if he can find his way to the Do Not Disturb control. He'll be called into Dr. Stamos's office at any minute, and he wants to get their conference over with. Like most elderly guys he knows, he doesn't like doctor's offices. He's always afraid they're going to find not just something wrong, but something really wrong. Besides, it's not like he doesn't know what his ex-partner wants to talk about. Pete's big retirement bash next month. It's going to be at the Raintree Inn out by the airport. Same place where Hodges' party took place, but this time he intends to drink a lot less. Maybe not at all. He had trouble with booze when he was active police. It was part of the reason his marriage crashed, but these days he seems to have lost his taste for alcohol. That's a relief. He once read a science fiction novel called The Moon is a Harsh Mistress. He doesn't know about the moon, but he would testify in court that whiskey is a harsh mistress, and that's made right here on Earth. He thinks it over, considers texting, then rejects the idea and gets up. Old habits are too strong. The woman behind the reception desk is Marley, according to her name tag. She looks about 17, gives him a brilliant cheerleader's smile.
He'll be with you soon, Mr. Hodges, I promise. We're just running a teensy bit behind. That's a Monday for you.
Monday, Monday, can't trust that day, Hodges says. She looks blank. I'm going to step out for a minute, okay? Have to make a call.
That's fine, Marley says. Just stand in front of the door. I'll give you a big wave if you're still out there when he's ready.
That works. Hodges stops by the old lady on his way to the door. Good book?
She looks up at him.
No, but it's very energetic.
So I've been told. Have you seen the movie?
She stares up at him, surprised and interested.
There's a movie?
Yes, you should check it out. Not that Hodges has seen it himself, although Holly Gibney, once his assistant, now his partner, a rabid film fan since her troubled childhood, tried to drag him to it. Twice. It was Holly who put the breaking pane of glass home run text alert on his phone. She found it amusing. Hodges did too. At first. Now he finds it a pain in the ass. He'll look up how to change it on the internet. You can find anything on the internet, he has discovered. Some of it is helpful. Some of it is interesting, some of it is funny, and some of it is fucking awful.
2.
Pete's cell rings twice and then his old partner is in his ear.
Huntley,
Hodges says. Listen to me carefully because you may be tested on this material later.
Yes, I'll be at the party. Yes, I'll make a few remarks after the meal, amusing but not raunchy, and I'll propose the first toast. Yes, I understand both your ex and your current squeeze will be there, but to my knowledge, no one has hired a stripper. If anyone has, it would be Hal Corley, who is an idiot, and you'd have to ask him.
Bill, stop. It's not about the party.
Hodges stops at once. It's not just the intertwined babble of voices in the background. Police voices. He knows that even though he can't tell what they're saying. What stops him dead is that Pete has called him Bill, and that means it's serious shit. Hodges' thoughts fly first to Corrine, his own ex-wife, next to his daughter Allison, who lives in San Francisco, and then to Holly. Christ, if something has happened to Holly.
What is it about, Pete?
I'm at the scene of what appears to be a murder-suicide. I'd like you to come out and take a look. Bring your sidekick with you if she's available and agreeable. I hate to say this, but I think she might actually be a little smarter than you are.
Not any of his people. Hodges' stomach muscles, tightened as if to absorb a blow, loosen, although the steady ache that's brought him to Stamos is still there.
Of course she is, because she's younger. You start to lose brain cells by the millions after you turn 60, a phenomenon you'll be able to experience for yourself in another couple of years. Why would you want an old cart horse like me at a murder scene?
Because this is probably my last case. Because it's going to blow up big in the papers, and because, don't swoon, I actually value your input. Gibney's too. And in a weird way, you're both connected. That's probably a coincidence, but I'm not entirely sure.
Connected how?
Does the name Martine Stover ring a bell?
For a moment it doesn't. Then it clicks in. On a foggy morning in 2009, a maniac named Brady Hartsfield drove a stolen Mercedes-Benz into a crowd of job seekers at City Center downtown. He killed 8 and seriously injured 15. In the course of their investigation, Detectives K. William Hodges and Peter Huntley interviewed a great many of those who had been present on that foggy morning, including all the wounded survivors. Martine Stover had been the toughest to talk to, and not only because her disfigured mouth made her all but impossible to understand for anyone except her mother. Stover was paralyzed from the chest down. Later, Hartsfield had written Hodges an anonymous letter. In it, he referred to her as your basic head on a stick. What made that especially cruel was the radioactive nugget of truth inside the ugly joke.
I can't see a quadriplegic as a murderer, Pete, outside an episode of Criminal Minds, that is. So, I assume...
Yeah, the mother was the doer. First she off Stover, then herself.
Coming?
Hodges doesn't hesitate.
I am. I'll pick up Holly on the way. What's the address?
1601 Hilltop Court in Ridgedale.
Ridgedale is a commuter suburb north of the city, not as pricey as Sugar Heights, but still pretty nice.
I can be there in 40 minutes, assuming Holly's at the office.
And she will be. She's almost always at her desk by 8, sometimes as early as 7, and apt to be there until Hodges yells at her to go home, fix herself some supper, and watch a movie on her computer. Holly Gibney is the main reason Finders Keepers is in the black. She's an organizational genius, she's a computer wizard, and the job is her life. Well, along with Hodges and the Robinson family, especially Jerome and Barbara. Once, when Jerome and Barbie's mom called Holly an honorary Robinson, she lit up like the sun on a summer afternoon. It's a thing Holly does more often than she used to, but still not enough to suit Hodges.
That's great, Kerm. Thanks.
Have the bodies been transported?
Off to the morgue as we speak, but Izzy's got all the pictures on her iPad.
He's talking about Isabel James, who has been Pete's partner since Hodges retired.
Okay, I'll bring you an eclair.
There's a whole bakery here already. Where are you, by the way?
Nowhere important. I'll get with you as soon as I can. Hodges ends the call and hurries down the hall to the elevator.
3. Dr. Stamos's 8:45 patient finally reappears from the exam area at the back. Mr. Hodges' appointment was for 9, but it's now 9:30. The poor guy is probably impatient to do his business here and get rolling with the rest of his day. She looks out in the hall and sees Hodges talking on his cell. Marley rises and peeks into Stamos's office. He's sitting behind his desk with a folder open in front of him. Kermit William Hodges, his computer printed on the tab. The doctor is studying something in the folder and rubbing his temple as though he has a headache.
Dr. Stamos, shall I call Mr. Hodges in?
He looks up at her, startled, then at his desk clock.
Oh, God, yes. Mondays suck, huh?
Can't trust that day, she says, and turns to go.
I love my job, but I hate this part of it, Stamos says.
It's Marley's turn to be startled. She turns to look at him.
Never mind. Talking to myself. Send him in. Let's get this over with.
Marley looks out into the hall, just in time to see the elevator door closing at the far end.
4.
Hodges calls Holly from the parking garage next to the medical center, and when he gets to the Turner building on Lower Marlboro, where their office is located, she's standing out front with her briefcase planted between her sensible shoes. Holly Gibney. Late 40s now. Tallish and slim. Brown hair usually scooped back in a tight bun. This morning wearing a bulky North Face parka with the hood up and framing her small face. You'd call that face plain, Hodges thinks, until you saw the eyes, which are beautiful and full of intelligence. And you might not really see them for a long time, because as a rule, Holly Gibney doesn't do eye contact. Hodges slides his Prius to the curb, and she jumps in, taking off her gloves and holding her hands up to the passenger side heating vent.
It took you a very long time to get here.
15 minutes. I was on the other side of town. I caught all the red lights.
It was 18 minutes, Holly informs him as Hodges pulls into traffic. Because you were speeding, which is counterproductive. If you keep your speed to exactly 20 miles an hour, you can catch almost all the lights. They're timed. I've told you that several times. Now, tell me what the doctor said. Did you get an A on your tests?
Hodges considers his options, which are only two. Tell the truth or prevaricate. Holly nagged him into going to the doctor because he's been having stomach issues. Just pressure at first, now some pain. Holly may have personality problems, but she's a very efficient nagger, like a dog with a bone, Hodges sometimes thinks. The results weren't back yet. This is not quite a lie, he tells himself, because they weren't back to me yet. She looks at him doubtfully as he merges onto the Crosstown Expressway. Hodges hates it when she looks at him that way. I'll keep after this, he says. Trust me.
I do, she says. I do, Bill.
That makes him feel even worse. She bends, opens her briefcase, and takes out her iPad.
I looked up some stuff while I was waiting for you. Want to hear it?
Hit me.
Martine Stover was 50 at the time Brady Hartsfield crippled her, which would make her 56 as of today. I suppose she could be 57, but since this is only January, I think that's very unlikely, don't you?
Odds are against, all right.
At the time of the city center event, she was living with her mother in a house on Sycamore Street, not far from Brady Hartsfield and his mother, which is sort of ironic when you think of it.
Also close to Tom Salbers and his family, Hodges muses. He and Holly had a case involving the Salbers family not long ago, and that one also had a connection to what the local newspaper had taken to calling the Mercedes Massacre. There were all sorts of connections when you thought about it. Perhaps the strangest being that the car Hartsfield had used as a murder weapon belonged to Holly Gibney's cousin. How does an elderly woman and her severely crippled daughter make the jump from the tree streets to Ridgedale?
Insurance. Martine Stover had not one or two whopping big policies, but three. She was sort of a freak about insurance.
Hodges reflects that only Holly could say that approvingly.
There were several articles about her afterward, because she was the most badly hurt of those who survived. She said she knew that if she didn't get a job at City Center, she'd have to start cashing her policies in one by one. After all, she was a single woman with a widowed, unemployed mother to support.
Who ended up taking care of her?
Holly nods. Very strange. Very sad. But at least there was a financial safety net, which is the purpose of insurance. They even moved up in the world.
Yes, Hodges says, but now they're out of it. To this, Holly makes no reply. Up ahead is the Ridgedale exit. Hodges takes it. 5. Pete Huntley has put on weight, his belly hanging over his belt buckle. But Isabel James is as smashing as ever in her tight, faded jeans and blue blazer. Her misty gray eyes go from Hodges to Holly and then back to Hodges again.
You've gotten thin,
she says. This could be either a compliment or an accusation.
He's having stomach problems, so he had some tests, Holly says. The results were supposed to be in today, but...
Let's not go there, Halls, Hodges says. This isn't a medical consultation.
You two are more like an old married couple every day,
Izzy says. Holly replies in a matter-of-fact voice.
Marriage to Bill would spoil our working relationship.
Pete laughs, and Holly shoots him a puzzled glance as they step inside the house. It's a handsome Cape Cod, and although it's on top of a hill and the day is cold, the house is toasty warm. In the foyer, All four of them put on thin rubber gloves and booties. How it all comes back, Hodges thinks, as if I was never away. In the living room, there's a painting of big-eyed waifs hung on one wall. A big-screen TV hung on another. There's an easy chair in front of the tube with a coffee table beside it. On the table is a careful fan of celebrity mags like OK and scandal rags like Inside View. In the middle of the room, there are two deep grooves in the rug. Hodges thinks this is where they sat in the evenings to watch TV, or maybe all day long. Mom in her easy chair, Martine in her wheelchair, which must have weighed a ton judging by those marks. What was her mother's name, he asks.
Janice Ellerton. Husband James died 20 years ago, according to...
Old school, like Hodges, Pete carries a notebook instead of an iPad. Now he consults it.
According to Yvonne Carstairs. She and the other aide, Georgina Ross, found the bodies when they arrived this morning shortly before 6. They got paid extra for turning up early. The Ross woman wasn't much help.
She was gibbering, Izzy says. Carstairs was okay, though. Kept her head throughout. Called the police right away, and we were on scene by 6:40.
How old was Mom? Hodges asks.
Don't know exactly yet, Pete says, but no spring chicken.
She was 79, Holly says. One of the news stories I searched while I was waiting for Bill to pick me up said she was 73 when the city center massacre happened.
Awfully long in the tooth to be taking care of a quadriplegic daughter, Hodges says.
She was in good shape, though, Isabel says, at least according to Carstairs. Strong, and she had plenty of help. There was money for it because...
Of the insurance, Hodges finishes. Holly filled me in on the ride over.
Izzy gives Holly a glance. Holly doesn't notice. She's measuring the room, taking inventory, sniffing the air, running a palm across the back of Mom's easy chair.
Holly has emotional problems. She's breathtakingly literal, but she's also open to stimuli in a way few people are. Pete says,
There were two aides in the morning, two in the afternoon, two in the evening, 7 days a week. Private company called, back to the notebook, Home Helpers. They did all the heavy lifting. There's also a housekeeper, Nancy Alderson, but apparently she's off. Note on the kitchen calendar says, Nancy in Chagrin Falls. There's a line drawn through today, Tuesday, and Wednesday.
Two men, also wearing gloves and booties, come down the hall. From the late Martine Stover's part of the house, Hodges assumes. Both are carrying evidence cases.
All done in the bedroom and bathroom, one of them says.
Anything? Izzy asks.
About what you'd expect, the other says. We got quite a few white hairs from the tub, not unusual considering that's where the old lady high-sided it. There was also excrement in the tub, but just a trace, also as you would expect.
Off Hodges' questioning look, the tech adds.
She was wearing continence pants. The lady did her homework.
Ook, Holly says. The first tech says.
There's a shower chair, but it's in the corner with extra towels stacked on the seat. Looks like it's never been used.
They would have given her sponge baths, Holly says. She still looks grossed out, either by the thought of continence pants or shit in the bathtub, but her eyes continue to flick everywhere. She may ask a question or two or drop a comment, but mostly she remains silent because people intimidate her, especially in close quarters. But Hodges knows her well as anyone can, at least, and he can tell she's on high alert. Later, she will talk, and Hodges will listen closely. During the Saubers case the year before, he learned that listening to Holly pays dividends. She thinks outside the box, sometimes way outside it, and her intuitions can be uncanny. And although fearful by nature, God knows she has her reasons, she can be brave. Holly is the reason Brady Hartsfield, a.k.a. Mr. Mercedes, is now in the Lakes Region Traumatic Brain Injury Clinic at Kiner Memorial. Holly used a sock loaded with ball bearings to crush in his skull before Hartsfield could touch off a disaster much greater than the one at City Center. Now he's in a twilight world the head neuro guy at the brain injury clinic refers to as a persistent vegetative state. Quadriplegics can shower, Holly amplifies. But it's difficult for them because of all the life support equipment they're hooked up to. So mostly it's sponge baths.
Let's go in the kitchen where it's sunny, Pete says, and to the kitchen they go.
The first thing Hodges notices is the dish drainer where the single plate that held Mrs. Ellerton's last meal has been left to dry. The countertops are sparkling and the floor looks clean enough to eat on. Hodges has an idea that her bed upstairs will have been neatly made. She may even have vacuumed the carpets. And then there's the continence pants. She took care of the things she could take care of. As a man who once seriously considered suicide himself, Hodges can relate.
6. Pete, Izzy, and Hodges sit at the kitchen table. Holly merely hovers, sometimes standing behind Isabel to look at the collection of photos on Izzy's iPad labeled Ellerton Stover, sometimes poking into the various cupboards, her gloved fingers as light as moths. Izzy takes them through it, swiping at the screen as she talks. The first photo shows two middle-aged women. Both are beefy and broad-shouldered in their red nylon home helper's uniforms, but one of them, Georgina Ross, Hodges presumes, is crying and gripping her shoulders so that her forearms press against her breasts. The other one, Yvonne Carstairs, is apparently made of sterner stuff.
"They got here at 5:45, Izzy says. "They have a key to let themselves in so they don't have to knock or ring. Sometimes Martine slept until 6:30, Carstairs says. Mrs. Ellerton is always up, gets up around 5, she told them. Had to have her coffee first thing. Only this morning she's not up, and there's no smell of coffee. So they think the old lady overslept for once, good for her. They tiptoe into Stover's bedroom, right down the hall, to see if she's awake yet. This is what they find." Izzy swipes to the next picture. Hodges waits for another oog from Holly, but she is silent and studying the photo closely. Stover is in bed with the covers pulled down to her knees. The damage to her face was never repaired, but what remains looks peaceful enough. Her eyes are closed and her twisted hands are clasped together. A feeding tube juts from her scrawny abdomen. Her wheelchair, which to Hodges looks more like an astronaut space capsule, stands nearby. In Stover's bedroom there was a smell. Not coffee, though. Booze. Izzy swipes. Here's a close-up of Stover's bedside table. There are neat rows of pills. There's a grinder to turn them to powder so that Stover could ingest them. Standing among them and looking wildly out of place is a fifth of Smirnoff triple distilled vodka in a plastic syringe. The vodka bottle is empty.
"The lady was taking zero chances," Pete says. "Smirnoff triple distilled is 150 proof."
"I imagine she wanted it to be as quick for her daughter as possible," Holly says. "Good call," Izzy says, but with a notable lack of warmth. She doesn't care for Holly, and Holly doesn't care for her. Hodges is aware of this, but has no idea why, and since they rarely see Isabel, he's never bothered to ask Holly about it.
"Have you got a close-up of the grinder?" Holly asks.
"Of course." Izzy swipes, and in the next photo, the pill grinder looks as big as a flying saucer. A dusting of white powder remains in the cup.
"We won't be sure until later this week, but we think it's oxycodone. Her script was refilled just 3 weeks ago, according to the label, but that bottle is as empty as the vodka bottle."
She goes back to Martine Stover, eyes closed, scrawny hands clasped, as if in prayer.
"Her mother ground up the pills, funneled them into the bottle, and poured the vodka down Martine's feeding tube. Probably more efficient than lethal injection."
Izzy swipes again.
This time Holly does say, "Oog," but she doesn't look away.
The first photo of Martine's handicap-equipped bathroom is a wide shot, showing the extra-low counter with its basin, the extra-low towel racks and cabinets, the jumbo shower-tub combination. The slider in front of the shower is closed. The tub in full view. Janice Ellerton reclines in water up to her shoulders, wearing a pink nightgown. Hodges guesses it would have ballooned around her as she lowered herself in, but in this crime scene photo it clings to her thin body. There is a plastic bag over her head, secured by the kind of terry cloth belt that goes with a bathrobe. A length of tubing snakes from beneath it, attached to a small canister lying on the tile floor. On the side of the canister is a decal that shows laughing children.
"Suicide kit," Pete says. "She probably learned how to make it on the Internet. There are plenty of sites that explain how to do it, complete with pics.
The water in the tub was cool when we got here, but probably warm when she climbed in.
Supposed to be soothing, Izzy puts in, and although she doesn't say ooh, her face tightens in a momentary expression of distaste as she swipes to the next picture. A close-up of Janice Ellerton. The bag had fogged with the condensation of her final breaths, but Hodges can see that her eyes were closed. She also went out looking peaceful.
The canister contained helium, Pete says. You can buy it at any of the big discount stores. You're supposed to use it to blow up the balloons at little Buster's birthday party, but it works just as well to kill yourself with once you have a bag over your head. Dizziness is followed by disorientation, at which point you probably couldn't get the bag off even if you changed your mind. Next comes unconsciousness, followed by death.
Go back to the last one, Holly says. The one that shows the whole bathroom.
Ah, Pete says. Dr. Watson may have seen something.
Izzy goes back. Hodges leans closer, squinting. His near vision isn't what it once was. Then he sees what Holly saw. Next to a thin gray power cord plugged into one of the outlets, there's a magic marker. Someone, Ellerton, he presumes, because her daughter's writing days were long over, drew a single large letter on the counter. Z.
What do you make of it? Pete asks.
Hodges considers. It's her suicide note, he says at last. Z is the final letter of the alphabet. If she'd known Greek, it might have been Omega.
That's what I think, too, Izzy says. Kind of elegant, when you think of it. Z is also the mark of Zorro, Holly informs him. He was a masked Mexican cavalier. There have been a great many Zorro movies, one starring Anthony Hopkins as Don Diego, but it wasn't very good.
Do you find that relevant? Izzy asks. Her face expresses polite interest, but there's a barb in her tone.
There was also a television series,
Holly goes on. She's looking at the photo as though hypnotized by it.
It was produced by Walt Disney back in the black and white days. Mrs. Ellerton might have watched it when she was a girl.
Are you saying she maybe took refuge in childhood memories while she was getting ready to off herself?
Pete sounds dubious, which is how Hodges feels.
I guess it's possible.
Bullshit, more likely,
Izzy says, rolling her eyes. Holly takes no notice.
Can I look in the bathroom? I won't touch anything, even with these.
She holds up her small gloved hands.
Be our guest, Izzy says at once.
In other words, Hodges thinks, buzz off and let the adults talk. He doesn't care for Izzy's tood when it comes to Holly, but since it seems to bounce right off her, he sees no reason to make an issue of it. Besides, Holly really is a bit skitsy this morning, going off in all directions. Hodges supposes it was the pictures. Dead people never look more dead than in police photos. She wanders off to check out the bathroom. Hodges sits back, hands laced at the nape of his neck, elbows winged out. His troublesome gut hasn't been quite so troublesome this morning, maybe because he switched from coffee to tea. If so, he'll have to stock up on PG tips. Hell, buy stock. He's really tired of the constant stomachache. Want to tell me what we're doing here, Pete? Pete raises his eyebrows and tries to look innocent.
Whatever can you mean, Kermit?
You were right when you said this would make the paper. It's the kind of sad soap opera shit people love. It makes their own lives look better to them.
Cynical, but probably true, Izzy says with a sigh.
But any connection to the Mercedes massacre is casual rather than causal.
Hodges isn't entirely sure that means what he thinks it means, but it sounds good.
What you've got here is your basic mercy killing committed by an old lady who just couldn't stand to see her daughter suffer anymore. Probably Ellerton's last thought when she turned on the helium was, I'll be with you soon, honey. And when I walk the streets of heaven, you'll be walking right beside me.
Izzy snorts at that, but Pete looks pale and thoughtful. Hodges suddenly remembers that a long time ago, maybe 30 years, Pete and his wife lost their first child, a baby daughter, to SIDS.
It's sad, and the papers lap it up for a day or two, but it happens somewhere in the world every day, every hour, for all I know. So tell me what the deal is.
Probably nothing. Izzy says it is nothing.
Izzy does, she confirms.
Izzy probably thinks I'm going soft in the head as I approach the finish line.
Izzy doesn't. Izzy just thinks that it's time you stop letting the bee known as Brady Hartsfield buzz around in your bonnet.
She switches those misty gray eyes to Hodges. Ms. Gibney there may be a bundle of nervous tics and strange associations, but she stopped Hartsfield's clock most righteously, and I give her full credit for it. He's zonked out in that brain trauma clinic at Kiner, where he'll probably stay until he catches pneumonia and dies, thereby saving the state a whole pot full of money. He's never going to stand trial for what he did. We all know that. You didn't catch him for the city center thing, but Gibney stopped him from blowing up 2,000 kids at Mingo Auditorium a year later. You guys need to accept that. Call it a win and move on.
Phew, Pete says. How long have you been holding that in?
Izzy tries not to smile, but can't help it. Pete smiles in return, and Hodges thinks, they work as well together as Pete and I did. Shame to break up that combination, it really is.
Quite a while, Izzy says. Now go on and tell him. She turns to Hodges. At least it's not little gray men from the X-Files.
So? Hodges asks.
Keith Freas and Krista Countryman, Pete says. Both were also at City Center on the morning of April 10th when Hartsfield did his thing. Freas, age 19, lost most of his arm, plus 4 broken ribs and internal injuries. He also lost 70% of the vision in his right eye. Countryman, age 21, suffered broken ribs, a broken arm, and spinal injuries that resolved after all sorts of painful therapy I don't even want to think about.
Hodges doesn't either, but he's brooded over Brady Hartsfield's victims many times, mostly on how the work of 70 wicked seconds could change the lives of so many for years, or in the case of Martine Stover, forever.
They met in weekly therapy sessions at a place called Recovery Is You and fell in love. They were getting better, slowly, and planned to get married. Then, in February of last year, they committed suicide together. In the words of some old punk song or other, they took a lot of pills and they died.
This makes Hodges think of the grinder on the table beside Stover's hospital bed. The grinder with its residue of oxycodone. Mom dissolved all the oxy in the vodka, but there must have been plenty of other narcotic medications on that table. Why had she gone to all the trouble of the plastic bag and the helium when she could have swallowed a bunch of Vicodin, chased it with a bunch of Valium, and called it good?
Freas and Countryman were the sort of youngster suicides that also happen every day, Izzy says. The parents were doubtful about the marriage, wanted them to wait, and they could hardly run off together, could they? Freas could barely walk, and neither of them had jobs. There was enough insurance to pay for the weekly therapy sessions and to kick in for groceries at their respective homes, but nothing like the kind of Cadillac coverage Martine Stover had. Bottom line, shit happens. You can't even call it a coincidence. Badly hurt people get depressed, and sometimes depressed people kill themselves.
Where did they do it?
The Freas boy's bedroom, Pete says, while his parents were on a day trip to Six Flags with his little brother. They took the pills, crawled into the sack, and died in each other's arms, just like Romeo and Juliet.
Romeo and Juliet died in a tomb,
Holly says, coming back into the kitchen.
In the Franco Zeffirelli film, which is really the best...
Yes, okay, point taken, Pete says. Tomb, bedroom, at least they rhyme.
Holly is holding the inside view that was on the coffee table, folded to show a picture of Johnny Depp that makes him look either drunk, stoned, or dead. Has she been in the living room reading a scandal sheet all this time? If so, she really is having an off day. Pete says,
have you still got the Mercedes, Holly, the one Hartsfield stole from your cousin Olivia?
No.
Holly sits down with a folded newspaper in her lap and her knees primly together.
I traded it last November for a Prius like Bill's. It used a great deal of gas and was not eco-friendly. Also, my therapist recommended it. She said that after a year and a half I had surely exercised its hold over me, and its therapeutic value was gone. Why are you interested in that?
Pete sits forward in his chair and clasps his hands together between his spread knees.
Hartsfield got into that Mercedes by using an electronic gizmo to unlock the doors. Her spare key was in the glove compartment. Maybe he knew it was there, or maybe the slaughter at City Center was a crime of opportunity. We'll never know for sure.
And Olivia Trelawney, Hodges thinks, was a lot like her cousin Holly. Nervy, defensive, most definitely not a social animal. Far from stupid, but hard to like. We were sure she left her Mercedes unlocked with the key in the ignition because that was the simplest explanation, and because, on some primitive level where logical thinking has no power, we wanted that to be the explanation. She was a pain in the ass. We saw her repeated denials as a haughty refusal to take responsibility for her own carelessness. The key in her purse, the one she showed us, we assumed that was just her spare. We hounded her, and when the press got her name, they hounded her. Eventually, she started to believe she'd done what we believed she'd done, enabled a monster with mass murder on his mind. None of us considered the idea that a computer geek might have cobbled together that unlocking gizmo, including Olivia Trelawney herself. But we weren't the only ones who hounded her. Hodges is unaware that he's spoken aloud until they all turn to look at him. Holly gives him a small nod as if they have been following the exact same train of thought, which wouldn't be all that surprising. Hodges goes on. It's true that we never believed her, no matter how many times she told us she took her key and locked her car, so we bear part of the responsibility for what she did, but Hartsfield went after her with malice aforethought. That's what you're driving at, isn't it? Yes, Pete says. He wasn't content with stealing her Mercedes and using it as a murder weapon. He got inside her head, even bugged her computer with an audio program full of screams and accusations. And then there's you, Kermit. Yes. There was him. Hodges had received an anonymous poison pin letter from Hartsfield when he was at an absolute low point, living in an empty house, sleeping badly, seeing almost no one except Jerome Robinson, the kid who cut his grass and did general repairs around the place, suffering from a common malady in career cops, end-of-watch depression.
Retired police have an extremely high suicide rate, Brady Hartsfield had written. This was before they began communicating by the 21st century's preferred method, the Internet. I wouldn't want you to start thinking about your gun, but you are thinking of it, aren't you?
It was as if Hartsfield had sniffed out Hodges' thoughts of suicide and tried to push him over the edge. It had worked with Olivia Trelawney, after all, and he'd gotten a taste for it.
When I first started working with you, Pete says, you told me repeat criminals were sort of like Turkish rugs. Do you remember that?
Yes. It was a theory Hodges had expounded to a great many cops. Few listened, and judging by her bored expression, he guessed Isabel Janes would have been one of those who did not. Pete had.
They create the same pattern, over and over. Ignore the slight variations, you said, and look for the underlying sameness. Because even the smartest doers, like Turnpike Joe, who killed all those women at rest stops, seemed to have a switch inside their brains that stuck on repeat. Brady Hartsfield was a connoisseur of suicide.
He was an architect of suicide, Holly says. She's looking down at the newspaper, her brow furrowed, her face paler than ever.
It's hard for Hodges to relive the Hartsfield business. At least he's finally managed to quit going to see the son of a bitch in his room in the brain injury clinic. But it's even harder for Holly. He hopes she won't backslide and start smoking again, but it wouldn't surprise him if she did.
Call it what you want, but the pattern was there. He goaded his own mother into suicide for Christ's sake.
Hodges says nothing to this, although he has always doubted Pete's belief that Deborah Hartsfield killed herself when she discovered, perhaps by accident, that her son was the Mercedes killer. For one thing, they have no proof that Mrs. Hartsfield ever did find out. For another, it was gopher poison the woman ingested, and that had to be a nasty way to go. It's possible that Brady murdered his mother, but Hodges has never really believed that either. If he loved anyone, it was her. Hodges thinks the gopher poison might have been intended for someone else, and perhaps not for a person at all. According to the autopsy, it had been mixed in with hamburger, and if there was anything dogs liked, it was a ball of raw ground meat. The Robinsons have a dog, a lovable, floppy-eared mutt. Brady would have seen him many times because he was watching Hodges' house and because Jerome usually brought the dog along when he cut Hodges' lawn. The gopher poison could have been meant for Odell. This is an idea Hodges has never mentioned to any of the Robinsons, or to Holly, for that matter. And hey, it's probably bullshit. But in Hodges' opinion, it's as likely as Pete's idea that Brady's mom offed herself. Izzy opens her mouth, then shuts it when Pete holds up a hand to forestall her. He is, after all, still the senior member of their partnership, and by quite a few years. Izzy's getting ready to say Martine Stover was murder, not suicide, but I think there's a very